It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new bill signed into law in Indiana on Monday makes it easier for developers to build on many of the state's most protected wetlands. Even though that's happening in Indiana, it could have literal downstream effects in the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes, including those that share a border with Wisconsin. States can roll back wetland protections because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last year that took away federal oversight for many wetlands, leaving it up to the states to decide how much they want to regulate them. We're talking about the rollback of wetlands protections in Indiana, the downstream effects it could have in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about who regulates wetlands, the role that wetlands play in our ecosystems? Do you want to see better protection here in Wisconsin, or do you think there's too much? It limits building and other development. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa Scanlon is professor and director of the Center for Water Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're going to dig into the details, Melissa, but big picture, why would a change in wetland regulations over in Indiana potentially affect us here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a great question. And it's because all of these waters are interconnected. And Indiana, what they do in that state will affect part of the Great Lakes, the part of Indiana that flows into the Great Lakes. And then another part of Indiana flows into the Mississippi River Basin. So they are upstream, so to speak, from these major water basins, and what they decide to do has ripple effects on all of us who share these waters.
I want to look at this U.S. Supreme Court case. This is from last year that really changed the landscape when it came to wetlands protections. The case challenged the EPA regulating wetlands, saying, hold on, congressional law only allows you to cover the federal government to protect, you know, rivers, lakes, navigable waterways. How big a change was that when it came to wetland protections?
Well, it's a pretty massive change. And the impact of the decision you're talking about is called Sackett versus EPA, and it was a U.S. Supreme Court decision from last May of 2023. In September, when the Environmental Protection Agency and the Corps of Engineers held a webinar where they were still assessing what they thought was the impact of that decision, they estimated that 63% of wetlands by acres are potentially impacted in terms of losing federal jurisdiction across the country.
Let's dig into the role of wetlands in ecosystems. Why do wetlands matter? Once upon a time, I think we looked at them as a thing to drain for development purposes. What do we lose when we do that?
Yeah, draining the swamp is, you know, common, and thinking about them as just places that grow mosquitoes, right? And that's one element of wetlands, and we know that they can be nasty places in that way, but that forgets the fact that wetlands are the Earth's kidneys. They store and filter contaminants. They leave water cleaner for swimming and fishing, the things that we like to do on these larger water bodies. And they also lower the costs for cleaning up drinking water for utilities, because the water that comes out of these wetlands comes out cleaner. They reduce and delay floods by capturing excess water. And, you know, flooding exacerbated by filling of wetlands could cost communities millions of dollars per year in cleanup and disaster relief efforts. So wetlands are these natural buffers that really help us. They're also nurseries for fish, wildlife, and birds. We're over here on Lake Michigan, and so we're particularly focusing on the Great Lakes. There are more than 80 species of Great Lakes fish that rely on wetlands to spawn, feed, and protect their young. So this is also something that is super critical for birds. Whether you are a a birder or not, it's important to have birds in our earth, right? And this is the Great Lakes coastal wetlands in particular are critical habitat for over 340 breeding, resident, and migratory bird species that depend on these ecosystems for their food and raising their young and resting as they're migrating through this area.
Melissa Scanlon is with us, director of the Center for Water Policy at UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences, looking at a big change after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last year when it comes to regulating and protecting wetlands. Federal government removed from those protections in many cases. Now it's up to the states. Changes in some states could affect us here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Tim is with us on the line in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I definitely feel that was a bad move on the Supreme Court. But as you can see by the Supreme Court that we have, it's all for corporations, and we're losing all of our environment. I mean, it was a Trump concept. Take everything you can, destroy everything in the process of doing it, and then who cares? You know, and what that woman said was true. You know, all that stuff, but we rely on hunting around here. There's a lot of pastimes we use that we need that wetlands for, not to mention just the fact for the natural wildlife. And we have tourism up here, and all this is going to do is put the kibosh on all these little people making money for corporate builders to come in there. And unfortunately, if they have enough money, it seems that they can just buy their way into whatever they want. And remember, the Supreme Court was handpicked, you could say, by the Republican think tank.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Melissa, this Indiana change in law is definitely a builders organizations advocated for changes in protections for wetlands there. How much development pressure has there been in recent history to build on places that are currently wetlands?
Well, you can look at how many wetlands we've lost already to kind of get at that question. In 1971, world leaders signed the Ramsar Convention to protect wetlands globally. And so we've had that convention in place for more than 50 years. And globally, we've lost 35% of the world's wetlands, according to the United Nations. These are deemed the most threatened ecosystem on Earth. And some places have lost even more than 35%. When you read about what happened in Indiana with their new law change rolling back protections for wetlands, Indiana has had lost already 85% of its wetlands in the 50 years since the Ramsar signing. So Indiana is worse off than generally across the globe, and they were rolling back protections even more.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Melissa Scanlon, professor and director of the Center for Water Policy at UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences, talking with us about how Indiana's decision to roll back wetlands regulation could affect waterways here in Wisconsin and big changes when it comes to federal regulation. A Supreme Court limits federal regulation of many wetlands nationwide. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live near wetlands here in Wisconsin? What kind of protections do you think these ecosystems should have? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about the far-reaching effects of a new Indiana law rolling back wetlands protections and a U.S. Supreme Court decision that allowed states to cut back on those wetland regulations. Our guest is Melissa Scanlon, professor and director of the Center for Water Policy at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the federal government should be more involved in protecting ecosystems like wetlands, or do you think these kind of decisions should be left up to the states? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa, we've talked about this Indiana change in laws. What is the current state of wetlands protection here in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because when the federal government's jurisdiction gets rolled back, as it just does, the focus really does shift to the states and tribes. And states and tribes may move to enhance wetland regulations to fill these gaps, or they might weaken them, like what we've seen this week in Indiana. And so Wisconsin is a great example of strengthening the regulations in the state in the wake of a similar type of decision. Now, back in 2001, the Supreme Court issued a different decision on wetlands. It was known as the Swank decision, and it removed federal jurisdiction over isolated wetlands. And our legislature came together and passed a comprehensive wetlands protection program that went far beyond federal jurisdiction to protect all wetlands within this state, including isolated ones. So we had a similar situation with rolling back jurisdiction and then the state really coming together to fill that gap. In 2017, our legislature took action to roll that back a little bit. They weakened it, put in some exemptions, but we still do have the overall structure intact. The larger point really is that now that it's left up to the states and tribes, it's going to be very fragmented. And you may have states that are moving to fill in these gaps, and you may have others that are rolling things back further. And I like how you phrase this question, and maybe we'll get some calls on it. I mean, do we want to have a uniform policy across the country on this? Because the impacts cross political boundaries, or are we just leaving this up to a fragmented approach that all the states and tribes can figure out how they're handling it?
Let's go back to our callers. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Well, hello. I'm so glad you're taking this subject up, and hallelujah for our directors of water. You're probably too young to know that 28 years or more ago, Perrier Nestle's came into Wisconsin and they bought 20 acres in Adams County, no zoning. They were going to drain the swamp and sell Ice Mountain from the Dells. Well, across the road in Columbia County, my dad had given me 160 acres of wetland 50 years ago, and he said, "Don't you ever drain it or sell it. It's for the future."
Chris, thanks for the call. I'm not sure how young you think I am, Chris. When I first started here at WPR, the Perrier controversy was a hot topic. I booked many talk show segments about it. Melissa, Chris says his dad gave him this land with that charge to preserve it for the future. How hard is it once we lose a wetland or drain it? Is it to bring it back, to restore it, or to something like its original state?
Well, thanks for the call, Chris. It is really so important that people who have private property with wetlands on them take that stewardship approach to protecting them, regardless of what the law says, and you know, go above and beyond to make sure that these gems are protected for us. So we all, and your neighbors, I'm sure, appreciate the service that you're providing. But do we really want to leave it up to voluntary approaches? I think that is the question. Is this so important that you don't want to leave it up to voluntary approaches and trying to do things after the fact to restore something that's already damaged, which is always much more difficult? Or do we want to have regulations in place that prevent damage to these precious ecosystems that really have ripple effects on so many people who are downstream from them?
And to Chris bringing up the Perrier example, how much of a threat to wetlands are things like extraction operations, pulling the water out of nearby groundwater for use, as opposed to, say, a filling in a wetlands for development?
Well, they definitely can be damaged by extracting water, and that was something that different tribes have been concerned about with protecting wetlands for wild rice and off-reservation extraction practices that are lowering groundwater and potentially lowering the water in the wetlands.
We heard from a caller, Gary in Appleton, who says, can downstream states sue the state of Indiana for the pollution? So if changes in Indiana regulations affect, say, the shores of Lake Michigan here in Wisconsin, for example, or affect flooding downstream in the Mississippi River Basin, do you see those affected states potentially taking legal action, Melissa?
Well, states can sue other states. It's very difficult to bring those cases. They're very fact intensive. And I would suggest that we want to have more proactive approaches that really take a more holistic view of the importance of wetlands for the country, and make sure that we aren't leaving it up to a piecemeal kind of after the fact litigation-based approach.
And just briefly, do you see room for a regional approach, kind of like the Great Lakes Compact, but maybe a Midwestern Wetlands Compact where states get together and at least have a regional solution?
Well, that's an interesting concept. I mean, there could be states getting together to have a race to the top, so to speak, in terms of protecting wetlands. That would take some political leadership amongst the Great Lakes states or the Mississippi states to do that.
Melissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Melissa Scanlon, professor and director of the Center for Water Policy at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. She talked to us today about a new law in Indiana rolling back wetlands regulation and how it'll affect water here in Wisconsin, plus a big change in law after U.S. Supreme Court ruling last year that sent wetlands protections back to the states in many cases. This week, local students from the Green Bay area will have the opportunity to play their instruments alongside talented musicians from the community. Joe Schultz has more on the upcoming concert of the Civic Symphony of Green Bay.
Classical music fills the band room at Ashwaubenon High School as the Civic Symphony of Green Bay rehearses for its February concert. The practice features students from Green Bay East High School performing alongside the orchestra. It's composed of community members from all walks of life. It's the Civic Symphony's 29th season. Artistic director Sung Young Graham has been with the group for 19 of those seasons.
We have so many wonderful people. You know, they may not be professional musicians, but they are very devoted and love playing music.
Graham says she tries to make each concert unique. This Friday's performance at St. Norbert College's Walter Theater focuses on educational outreach. The concert will include performances by kids as young as elementary school age playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. It will also feature more complex pieces performed by students from middle school through college and community members. More than 160 musicians will come together for the performance. In addition to the concert Friday night, the orchestra will play two smaller performances in front of local school children.
I wanted the Civic Symphony to be really integrated in the community. So not just a standing alone group, but actually we can teach our students, our children, to see where it's going.
One of the Green Bay East students performing is Lydia Hanold, a sophomore violinist. At the rehearsal, she practices a violin section solo from the song Romanian Folk Dances. She says it's a little nerve-wracking to be one of the youngest performers with the orchestra.
It feels really scary because I'm not used to performing with, like, older people. I've been in groups before, but it was always, like, very age-ranged. But it's also pretty cool because it's, like, different experiences, different people.
At the recent rehearsal, Graham reassures Hanold that she's doing great.
I know this is the first time, like, oh my God, I'm playing in front of all these people, and you are playing beautifully. You have a beautiful tone. So
don't worry about that. Just play out.
Green Bay East Orchestra Director Joseph Baltus is thrilled to see his students perform with the Civic Symphony.
A performance like this, to rehearse with skilled musicians in the community, it's an awesome opportunity for these kids.
St. Norbert College cellist Simon Whiteley is especially passionate about sharing his love of classical music with future generations. He plans to be a music educator after college. He says a lot of the music we hear today, and a lot of the music that the kids in the audience will hear this week, has roots that date back hundreds of years.
This is something that doesn't stop evolving and that can tell a lot. It also, to me, I think, is the easiest way to kind of cross cultural boundaries.
In fact, Whiteley is so passionate about the genre that he listens to it outside of school and rehearsal.
I get made fun of from close family members as well as friends. I have this playlist on Spotify that's about 48 hours straight of just classical music.
He's not the only one at the rehearsal with a deep passion for classical music. As he practices for this weekend's performance, he plays shoulder to shoulder with local musicians of all ages. Classical music is becoming more popular with young audiences. That's according to a survey published by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in December. It found the percentage of people under 25 interested in learning more about orchestral music rose from 6% in 2022 to 17% last year. That's exactly the sort of appreciation the Civic Symphony of Green Bay is hoping to foster. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time. And remember, you could follow great reporting from the WPR News team all the time over at WPR.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Our pets do a lot for us. They provide laughs, companionship, and a way to help us connect with other people. That might be on a Facebook group about pets, meeting people at the dog park, or just meeting a new neighbor when you're out for a walk. Right now, we want to hear how your pets have helped you create new connections. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Have you found a community of dog or cat or fish or bird or lizard lovers, whatever kind of pet you might have? Does having a pet lead to more spontaneous chats with people you haven't met before? Do you have any lasting friendships that you could thank your pet for? And how about within your family? Have your pets brought you closer together? Let us know what your pets do for you and how they bring you together with others by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Pets have been responsible for at least one classic big screen meet cute romance in 101 Dalmatians. Pongo drags his owner Roger out for a walk in the park with the intent to introduce him to Anita and, of course, her dog Perdita. Here's Pongo taking charge.
At first, I was afraid we'd miss them. Perhaps they passed on by the park. Then suddenly, I spotted them. It was a perfect situation if I planned it right. Uh-huh. I couldn't depend on Roger. I knew what he'd do. He'd settle down on the grass and puff his pipe, and that'd be it. No, it was all up to me. Well, I was determined that somehow they just had to meet.
And, of course, they get tangled up in the leashes and their lives. Next stop, spoiler alert, marriage and lots of little Dalmatians. How about you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you stop for a chat with somebody walking their dog or while you're walking your dog, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina joins us now in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I grew up with dogs, but I haven't owned one for 17 years. And during the onset of COVID, I developed an autoimmune condition that affects my breathing. So to turn the focus away from my physical challenge, I adopted an abused emaciated dog about 9 months ago. And immediately I got her into training over at the Overdale Kennels in Spring Valley. And I feel like with this group, we have found our tribe, and Amber and I are very happy helping each other.
Excellent. So, Christina, I assume you are, you know, chatting, having conversations with people in the training group, and you know, I'm sorry, what was your dog's name again?
Amber St. Clair.
And Amber's making friends, too.
You bet. Yes. Yes, we have found our tribe, and it's a group of great people, and we're both learning from each other.
I'm so happy for you and Amber St. Clair. Christina, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. As we ask you to share, how does your pet help you connect with other people? Friends, family, neighbors, you name it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I have a 8-year-old rescued greyhound named Matka. She is the perfect dog. Everybody should get a greyhound. I feel like it has brought me, like, I moved into a new house, and so I didn't know my neighbors, so I was chatting with them. But I feel like more importantly, it has brought me closer with my stepdaughters, because, you know, they're always on their phones or whatnot, and I feel like when we take Matka on a walk together, we talk about, you know, important things or just, you know, what they're doing, you know, throughout their, you know, week.
I love it. How old are your stepdaughters, Liz?
I have a 16, she's going to be 16, going to drive, Kylie, and I have a 9-year-old, going to be 10, Addie.
Kylie, Addie, and Matka, the Greyhound. Thank you so much, Liz. That is a perfect story at 800-642-1234. You know, we ask around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Speaking of Greyhounds, our reporter Hope Kerwin says, my husband and I have a Greyhound who's a retired race dog. When we adopted her in 2018, we had no idea we were joining a whole Greyhound community. The organization has a very active Facebook group where people share photos of their hounds, ask for advice, and even organize meetups. It's really fun. And Hope goes on, we get asked a lot about our girl Katie when we're out on walks. People instantly recognize her as a Greyhound because of the unique body shape. They always seem excited to see one in person. You could join in with your story about how pets bring you together with other people, whether it's neighbors, strangers out for that walk, an online community, you name it. 800-642-1234, a family members as well. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Carolyn is with us in Madison. Carolyn, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about?
Well, my husband and I got pretty lazy during COVID. We had just lost our dog of many years right before COVID. And we didn't feel ready to get a dog. But after COVID, we finally said, yeah, it's time. Finally picked up a dog in September a couple years back. And we proceeded to hike Devil's Lake Bluff every single Saturday and Sunday for over a year. We've passed the 2-year mark. We still get up there most weekends for a hike. And, of course, we see the other people that hike every weekend, that they have their dogs. And it's just been a great thing for us to get the dog and got us back out doing something. It's been wonderful.
I love it. And, Carolyn, are you at a point where you're starting to see, you know, the same people and the same dogs if you're going out there every weekend?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There's a certain group that hikes it every weekend around the same time we do. We're early birds to miss the crowds in the summer. And winter, it's pretty much sunrise. And we mostly have the park to ourselves a lot of winter days when it's really cold. But there's a certain group of people with their dogs that we see all the time.
And did you say up the bluffs? You're not just going around the lake trail, but you're actually going up top?
Oh, yeah. We go up and over every weekend.
Wow. Oh, and we better get a name for your dog, Carolyn.
Zoe.
All right. Look forward to meeting Zoe at Devil's Lake next time I'm up there. We are asking you to share your pet stories with us, especially when it comes to how pets bring you together with other people. And we've had a few great examples, whether it's, you know, Carolyn and Zoe and partner getting out there, getting active again, meeting people along the way, other things within families, or just meeting those neighbors or joining a group based on what kind of pet you have. You can join in at 800-642-1234. A line is open for you there right now. 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Becker from Audience Services here at WPR, Wisconsin Public Media as well, says, I have 4 grown children, and they're all pet owners / pet lovers and do not have children of their own, but lots of pet babies. We created a Snapchat channel. It's just for our family called Pet Chat, where we snap pictures a few times a day of just the pets. It is closely monitored to be only pet snaps, and everyone is called out and banning is threatened if there are violations. I love it, Chris. Thank you so much for sharing that. Back to your stories at 800-642-1234. Lisa is on the line in Oshkosh. Lisa, what's your story?
Okay, so right now I have a black and tan coon hound. His name is Watson. And he and I go out walking every day. That's super beneficial to me because my instinct is to stay inside and read all day. it helps me stay active, and I meet my neighbors who I probably wouldn't if I didn't have the dog, so that's terrific. And then previously, I had a dog, and I was married, and my spouse passed away, and I had to sell our house and move. That dog, if I didn't have that dog, I would have never gone outside, never met my neighbors. I was in a kind of bad place, and sure, he really, really helped me heal.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Lisa. Now, I've got to ask, nowadays, if you are in that reading mood and don't want to go outside, do you feel some pressure from your household to get out and take that walk anyway?
Oh, no, no. I will always take my dog for walks. I'm always going to have a dog because of that.
Excellent. I love it. Lisa, thank you so much. What a great story. I'm glad you shared that with us at 800-642-1234. Maddie joins us now in Cedarburg. Maddie, hi.
Hey, how you doing, Rob?
Good. Tell us about your pets, Maddie.
Well, I had 2 amazing Labrador retrievers that had wonderful time up in Pembine, Wisconsin on Lundgren Lake that we would throw the duck. We never took them duck hunting, although they would have been good bird dogs. But the neighbors, it brought a lot of people out onto this no-wake lake on their little paddle boats and canoes, especially some elderly couples that got them out and kind of meet and greet with some of the neighbors on some beautiful summer days. They just enjoyed watching the dogs run the full length of the pier as we threw the buoy out into the lake, and literally brought people out of their cottages to come and just watch Kaylee and Kira. It was just amazing memories. My nieces loved it. It really kind of got a lot of people loving dogs that weren't familiar with them. And a few people actually ended up getting Labrador puppies over the few summers we were up there.
No kidding. Maddie, thank you. What a great story, providing entertainment for everybody on the lake. I love it. We are asking for your stories about how your pets help you connect with other people, whether that's within your own household or with other family members. Maybe it's your neighbors. Maybe it's everybody else out on the lake. A lot of great stories so far. How about you? Have you met a community of pet lovers like you in person or maybe online? Has your pet helped you strike up a friendship with a neighbor or someone you might have otherwise never met? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We are inviting your stories, taking your calls. You are our guest about how your pets help you connect with other people. Have your pets ever helped you strike up new conversations, maybe friendships with people, or helped you gotten to know your neighbor, maybe while you're out at the dog park, out for a walk? Maybe you've connected with a community of pet lovers online, or maybe it's something that brought you and another family member together. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in now. Got a few minutes left to take your call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. John is with us in Winona, Minnesota. John, what did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I just recently adopted my grandpa's dog. He had two golden retrievers, and the older one unfortunately passed away and just kind of was left in a single dog household. And we have a white lab, and so we just adopted him, and it's brought us closer to my grandpa, and he loves being able to still have him around in the family. And yeah, it's just a great joy. And as an 8-year-old golden retriever, it's almost like he's about 2 years old again. So it's just always been really fun.
And grandpa's dog and your dog are buddies?
I adopted him from my grandpa. Mm, it was pretty awesome. He's 80 years old and just remarried in December. So he's having a fantastic time and wanted the dog to make sure that he was being a dog.
Wonderful. John, thanks so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Mary joins us now in Rubicon. Mary, hi.
Hi. I have a story about I used to dog sit for a woman that was out of the country for 6 months of the year. A different friend of mine introduced me to her. We met. And I took care of her little dog while she was out of the country. And then over the summer, she'd come back and get her dog back. Well, that lasted for 3 or 4 years. And the last time she had the dog, he wasn't happy anymore at her home. So she lovingly gave him up to me. And we stayed good friends all this while. And although little Ollie passed away now, we're still very close friends, and she's always encouraging me to get another dog, but not so far.
Are you thinking about it still, Mary?
Well, at this time, my husband and I like to travel. We're retired. Okay. But Patty and I have stayed good friends because of our mutual little friend, Ollie.
I love it. Thank you, Mary. And I'm glad that friendship is still going strong, taking your stories about how your pets connect you with other people. Friendships like Mary's, connections with family members, strangers that you talk to about your dog, their dog. Join in at 800-642-1234. It's not all dogs. Kate Crawford here at Wisconsin Public Media said, I found a Facebook group for orange cats. I have an orange cat named Milo, who I adopted from the Dane County Humane Society. Orange cats are known for being wild and off the wall. Milo is both wild and off the wall, but also the most loving cat ever. Kate says, my girls also love Milo, especially my oldest. She had a fear of animals before he got the cat. Having a pet has really been beneficial for her. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jenna joins us now in Sheboygan. Jenna, what did you want to tell us about?
Hi, I adopted a dog from the Humane Society of Sheboygan County in 2022. He was part of a hoarding case with 20 other dogs brought in at the same time. I was working at the shelter volunteering at the time, and I ended up falling in love with one of these dogs, and several of my fellow volunteers and staff members also fell in love with these dogs. A bunch of us ended up adopting them. Some went to other members of the community, and now I'm still in touch pretty regularly with several of the other adopters, as we're all kind of navigating how to teach a dog how to be a dog when they've never been around humans before we adopted them.
Oh, do you and the other adopters get together for play dates for the dogs?
We do from time to time, yeah.
Jenna, thanks a lot. What a great thing to do, and I'm glad you're all able to support each other in that way. We are taking your stories about how your pets have brought you together with other people. Maybe you met someone. Maybe it's just friendly chats with strangers out on the street while you're walking a dog. Maybe you see him again. Maybe you don't. Could be family members or an online group. Still time for your call, and a line or two has opened up for you now if you tried to call in earlier. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear your stories about how your pets help you connect with other people. Man, tell us about the pet while you're at it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call just the next few minutes. That's 800-642-1234. Here at Central Time, our own Colleen Leahy says, I just spent a bunch of time in Florida, and I went to the dog beach almost every day with my dachshund, Ernie. We all know about Ernie here. Colleen says, I had the same conversation with every person I talked to. What's your dog's name? How old are they? And what kind of dog are they? This was such a fun script, Colleen says. It never got old, and I talked with a lot of people I wouldn't have otherwise. The best dog name I encountered, another dachshund. Colleen's a little biased there toward dachshunds, I think. A dachshund, a black mini named Raisin. Still time for your call to share your story at 800-642-1234. Got an email from Ryan in Madison. Ryan says, I adopted my life-saving dog, Dolly, the Blackmouth Cur, from the Door County Humane Society during the pandemic. There's so many stories I could tell about her, but one of the more poignant ones happened within the first year I had her. Ryan says, my dad and I had gotten into a pretty bad verbal disagreement. The result is not speaking for several months. Within that time, my dad ended up refencing in his yard for my dog, which is a pretty big project. One of my friends dubbed it the Apology Fence. It has served as her private dog park and a great place for her to stay when I have to go out of town. And of course, things are all fine with my dad. Love it. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ryan, at 800-642-1234. Gene joined us now in Cedarburg. Gene, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. We have two dogs. We have a 10-year-old black cocker spaniel by the name of Reggie White and an 8-year-old English setter by the name of Rosie. We live in Cedarburg, and we walk the dogs downtown through Cedarburg. We're about a 10-minute walk from downtown, and we walk them all around on the trail, and they love to meet people. The setter is a certified therapy dog through Pets Helping People, and we'll visit the local nursing home. And the Cocker Spaniel is very well trained and disciplined, although he has a lot of opinions and does not qualify for therapy dog work. However, he is extremely friendly with people. He just, he loves to give kisses, and we tell people he can't hold his liquor.
And I got to ask, when I think of a dog named Reggie White, I think Cocker Spaniel doesn't lead to mind. Do we worry about being tackled by Reggie here?
No, Reggie is about 35 pounds. He's black with a white stripe. He's now getting a little gray in his muzzle and on the inside of his ears, but he is he's a very strong and confident dog.
Love it. Thank you so much, Gene. Time for one more caller. David is with us in Appleton. David, tell us your pet story.
Well, my parents had cats before they had me, so I grew up as a cat person. And my wife never had a pet in her entire life. In fact, it was a 2-month battle to let her keep my cat with me. But now she can't live without him. You know, typical cat, crazy cat lady. We've got a whole box full of toys, and she loves playing them with the laser. And she gets all freaked out when she can't find the cats. And I had to explain to her, this is what cats do when they're bored. They go hide and have you look all over the house for them.
Fantastic, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Hey, thanks to everybody for sharing your stories about pets and people and how pets help you connect with other people. If you still want us to let us know how your pets have helped you find maybe a new community of people or new friends, still time for you to email. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we get a couple few stories there via email, you can share them tomorrow or maybe next week. Again, email your pet people connection stories, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin Congressional Representative Mark Pocan joins the program for a look at the federal budget, a cabinet impeachment vote this week, plus other big issues facing Congress in the weeks to come. Join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. A 400-meter race is a tough distance for runners. You kind of want to sprint, but you got to pace yourself, too. And you have to be careful not to drop your pancake. Okay, that's one particular race. As reported by the AP, a foot race in England goes back to the 1400s. On the day before Lent, women in this community run a course carrying a frying pan with a pancake on it. The course goes along a legendary event where a woman apparently was running late to a pre-Lent church service, pancake in hand. Contestants have to flip their pancakes at the beginning and the end of the race. It's a very local event, but a community in Kansas has recreated it and runs it each year, too. This year's winning times for the 415-yard pancake race, 63.37 seconds in England, 63.03 seconds in Kansas. An open question not covered in that AP article, does anybody actually eat the pancakes? On your marks, get set, go get some maple syrup. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Sex education has been the subject of controversy in U.S. schools, with basic questions about how to teach students about their changing bodies, sexual health, birth control, and whether some or all of those topics should be in schools in the first place. Standards can be different from state to state and district to district. Throw in political polarization around education and around social issues, but this could be a tough time to teach sex education. Our next guest wanted to dig into the experience of educators working in this field and recently completed a study where she talked with 55 sex educators from all over the U.S. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how sex ed is and isn't taught in Wisconsin? Are you a student or are you raising a student currently going through Growth and Development Unit here in Wisconsin or one of our neighboring states? What are your thoughts on what's being taught and how? Are there changes you'd like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Orla Heyman is Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW Oshkosh, where she researches how people are able to navigate contentious health situations, including sex education and abortion. Orla, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into your survey, Orla, can you give us some sense of how we treat sex education here in Wisconsin when it comes to statewide standards or lack of same?
Yeah, so one thing that can be kind of confusing about sex education policy in Wisconsin is that sex education is not mandated in the state. But at the same time, HIV and STI education is mandated. And so they have a difference in scope. And just because Wisconsin doesn't mandate sex education, that doesn't necessarily mean that schools can't provide it. So really the only requirement that Wisconsin has is that if you do teach sex education, then it has to stress abstinence until marriage as the best and preferred choice. And in Wisconsin, sex education does not have to include really any information about contraception or consent or healthy relationships. And it doesn't even have to be evidence-based or medically accurate. So it leaves a lot of room for variation in whether young people in Wisconsin are getting sex education at all. And if they are, you know, what they're learning or not learning from these lessons.
So it sounds like there's a lot of leeway for individual school districts, public and private, as to how and whether they deal with these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these decisions are really made at the local level. So there's, you know, that includes the state government, but also decisions made by school districts or individual schools and school boards.
That's Wisconsin. Do different states do things differently? Do some mandate more specific kinds of sex education?
They do, yeah. A state that is often talked about with sex education is like a state like California, for example. So they require sex education in all of their public, middle, and high schools. And it has to be medically accurate. It has to be culturally appropriate, age appropriate. And it has to cover certain things like covering healthy relationships, for example.
Orla Heyman is with us, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. We're talking about sex education in schools, what there is, what there isn't, and a survey she did of sex educators around the country. We'll get to that in just a moment. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with sex ed in a school recently or in the distant past. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Orla, what made you want to reach out to sex educators around the country for their perspective?
Yeah, it kind of all goes back to a contradiction that I noticed. Policymakers and school boards and parents are actually largely in agreement that we need sex education in schools in order to address things like teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. And at the same time, how we should implement sex education is really hotly contested at every level of society, with all of these stakeholders trying to influence what sex education should look like. You know, should we be stressing the importance of abstinence until marriage as the societal standard, or maybe we should stress the importance of preventative measures like communication skills or condoms or birth control? And really, sex educators are the people who are on the ground doing this work, and they're responsible for implementing these various curricula. So they're kind of caught in the middle of all this. And it turns out there's actually been very little research that describes what this all means for sex educators and what it's like to navigate this context. So my research was really aimed at understanding current sex education from the perspectives of sex educators themselves. I wanted to compare their experiences and understand what kinds of challenges they face when they're teaching a controversial topic in K through 12 schools.
Now, depending on people's experience, they might remember any sex ed they had might have been taught by the gym teacher or the biology teacher or the teacher who drew the short straw, maybe. What qualifies as a sex educator? Who were you talking to for your study?
Yeah, it's a great question because it can actually, like you said, can include all kinds of people. So the way I defined it is anyone who delivers sexual health instruction in a K through 12 school as part of their job. So that would include both of the groups who really do this work in schools. So that's both teachers, as you mentioned, and also community educators. And so that was one of the kind of innovative parts of this research, because most studies don't actually differentiate between these two groups who are doing this work.
And how often is it teachers versus, and this is interesting, as something you found or talked about a little bit, is outside independent contractors being taught and who might specialize in this kind of education more often. How common is that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't know for certain how common it is because there's been no sort of national demographic survey of sex educators. So it's a little bit of guesswork. But one of the things that I found from my interviews with sex educators in different parts of the country is that they are noting that there is, we're undergoing sort of a shift in sex education where it really is increasingly being taught by, as you said, outside independent contractors instead of traditional teachers. And so we're talking about community sex educators who work for local community health organizations and come into a school, a classroom to teach sex ed for a limited period of time.
What are the pros and cons as you think about that kind of approach, bringing in somebody maybe more specialized, but maybe they don't know the kids' names?
Yeah, it's a big question. So really, teachers and community educators, I find, can have different kinds of training and background and motivations for teaching sex ed. you know, teachers tend to be great classroom managers, and they know their students. You know, many of them have developed relationships with their students over several years. And of course, they're trained to teach as well. And so those can all be great benefits in the sex ed classroom so that young people feel comfortable covering these topics. On the other hand, though, most teachers have not specifically studied sexual health or how to facilitate these kinds of conversations. And in some cases, you might have a math or a science teacher who's teaching sex ed, and they likely haven't really prepared to do this, and maybe didn't even want to in the first place. There were some sex educators who told me that teaching sex ed for some teachers is considered kind of an undesirable gig. And so sometimes it can go to the least experienced and newest teachers.
Big picture, what kind of challenges and concerns did you hear from the sex educators you talked to?
Yeah, so it really ran the gamut. So one challenge is a lack of time. So from talking to sex educators, it sounds like sex education isn't necessarily given very high priority in the school curriculum. So some places might get a few weeks of sex education, but other places might get just a few days or even just a single, you know, hour-long visit from a sex educator. And so this really puts sex educators in a difficult place, trying to figure out what topics to prioritize when they have very limited time in the classroom. And when sex education is integrated into the health curriculum, as it sometimes is, it then has to compete for time with other health topics like nutrition and fitness and substance use and hygiene and so on, which are also all very important, but it's difficult to figure out how to prioritize those. And some sex educators feel that sex ed comes too late in the curriculum as well. Sometimes they only get to talk to young people after some of them have already become sexually active, or they're only invited into schools after there's been an incident, like a sexual assault or a pregnancy. So some of them are frustrated that sex education isn't considered more preventative, and would like to be doing these lessons a little bit earlier.
We're talking about the state of sex education with Orla Heyman, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. She recently finished a study that included interviews with 55 sex educators from around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? If you've ever taught sex education in the schools, how does what you're hearing about match up with your own experience? If you're a parent, if you're a student or a recent student yourself, what do you wish was taught when it came to sex education in your school? Has this ever been a controversial issue in your district or your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orla Heyman, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. We're talking about sex education in Wisconsin and around the country. Orla's sharing some results of a study she recently finished looking at shifts and trends for sex educators and some of the challenges they face trying to do their jobs effectively. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences, a parent, a student, a teacher, yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Coree is with us in Belleville. Coree, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to share with us, Coree?
I have a middle schooler. We're in Belleville. I've been kind of just taken aback by the lack of just correct information and professionalism of our sex education department. There's a health teacher who teaches to both the middle school and the high school. My son's come back telling me that the teacher can't even say in class or won't anatomical parts, like referred to things as a carrot and a cream-filled donut. But I just like, what kind of education is my son getting at the school if someone is even like embarrassed to, you know, say
what, you know.
Anatomical terms. I gotcha. Karit, thanks for the call. Orla, is this something you hear either anecdotally or maybe from the people you talk to directly, shying away even from basic anatomical terms?
Yeah, it is actually. And I think, I mean, it can come from a few different places. There's the possibility that there's, you know, a lack of training, especially when teachers are kind of pushed into teaching sex education without some proper education and training for them. But it also has to do with people's comfort levels sometimes. But one of the things that I heard a lot from sex educators, especially in certain parts of the country, is that some of them feel really limited in what they feel they can say or teach in the classroom. So some sex educators told me that they wish that they could teach about condoms, for example, because they know that they have sexually active students in their classes, but they're afraid that if they did, that they're worried they could lose their teaching license over it. Another sex educator told me that they couldn't tell students about their full range of reproductive options if a student was sexually assaulted. And someone else told me a story about a student asking a question in class, and she told them, "Oh, I can't answer that." And the student responded, "Well, isn't that why you're here, to teach us about real life things?" And she said, "Yes, that's absolutely correct," but she doesn't want to lose her job. So some sex educators feel really constrained in what they can say, and they often feel like it's doing a real disservice to young people that they teach.
Karit, thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. And Orla, following up on that point, and presumably teachers watch the news, they might see angry confrontations at school board meetings over sensitive social issues. District administrators see the same things. Are people just kind of gun-shy? They don't want to be the next viral controversy if somebody doesn't like the way sex education is taught.
I think some people are. And there's a huge range, definitely. But I heard from some sex educators that some schools are definitely worried about becoming a scandal on their local news, and they don't want that. But really, one of the things that sex educators told me is that they're constantly having to push against these misconceptions about what sex education is. Some people assume that sex education is encouraging young people to have sex, which, you know, sort of stirs up a lot of this controversy. And the sex educators I talked to really did not feel like that accurately portrayed their approach to sex education. For them, they talked a lot about the need to provide young people with information and tools and strategies to make informed decisions. And interestingly, not only did they talk about people having misperceptions about sex education, but that also sometimes has implications for how they are perceived by others as well. So some of them told me that they feel like they're seen as sexual deviants, and in some cases are accused of being sexual predators even. One sex educator told me about being confronted by an armed parent in a school parking lot who was upset that she was teaching sex education in the school. Another sex educator told me about being labeled a pervert in a local newspaper. So sex educators I talked to felt like they were being perceived as these sexual deviants just for teaching about sexual health.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Okay, well, I'm calling about what they're bringing up right now and how teachers are expected to teach sex education, but when they do teach it in a practical form in the class, the parents come after them, and like you're just talking about right now, there's been cases where they're labeled as this and that, and they're just trying to do their job. My question is, where are the parents? Where is the parents' involvement in sex education? Why can't they support the teachers and be realistic about, you know, this is what you got to understand about sex. This is the way things work with the human body.
Daryl, thanks for the call. Orla, do you see successful ways to bridge those gaps when the parents don't like the very notion of sex ed, ways that teachers and administrators and parents can somehow still work together?
Yeah, well, and I would also note that really research finds that the vast majority of parents of like middle and high schoolers, for example, support having sex education taught in schools. And actually a majority of those parents support sex education that, you know, teaches about things like condoms and other forms of contraception, for example. There are those who feel more worried about that, and they tend to be sort of loud, but they are actually a minority. And so I think it's important for parents that feel like they want to support sex education in their school and are interested in what's being taught there to really get, you know, talk to principals, talk to superintendents, show up to school board meetings, and make sure that your thoughts on that are known and that they know that parents in the community really support that.
Thanks again for that call. Orla, you're a college professor. You work with students who are just out of high school themselves. What kind of things do you hear from them about the range of sex ed that they've received and their thoughts about what sex ed they received?
Yeah, I teach some classes on sort of sex and sexualities, and often we will talk about sex education at some point during the semester. And as I've been teaching that class, I've been hearing from students who've grown up in Wisconsin, and really one of the things I hear from them a lot is a sense of betrayal, really, feeling like they maybe weren't actually supported in a way that they, you know, found helpful or sufficient for them in their sex education. And especially as we start talking about what sex education can look like in other places, when they realize that the way that it's done in Wisconsin isn't necessarily the only way and isn't the way that it's done elsewhere, they get a little angry about it, honestly, a little indignant.
And just our last less than a minute, Orla, what do we lose if we don't have quality sex education?
Yeah, I think that it really comes down to people's sexual health in the end. So if we want sort of low teen pregnancy rates, if we want low rates of STIs, for example, we need to sort of be talking about these things and in a way that doesn't make people feel sort of ashamed or shut down. And really recent trends reported by the CDC show that sexual activity has actually been declining among young people since 2011. But when they are sexually active, they're less likely to use condoms. And also their experiences of sexual violence have also increased, especially for female high school students. So including lessons about contraception, including condoms, and also about things like sexual violence and consent are really, really important.
Orla, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Orla Heyman, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW Oshkosh. We talked to her about sex ed policy in Wisconsin and a recent study looking at shifts and challenges for sex educators around the country. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's another big step toward a change of election maps in Wisconsin, with Republican lawmakers approving a map originally drawn by Governor Evers, with the state Supreme Court and a big election waiting in the wings. We'll get the latest news. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with great Chinese recipes we can make at home. It's a very Chinese cookbook from America's Test Kitchen. Those conversations and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.